And this may hook into unrecognized or overlooked pain, but I gather that sometimes what goes with this in senior dogs is, behavioral changes, that is you start to see signs of aggression that you otherwise weren't seeing typically in
that dog. Exactly, yes. Unfortunately, that's a really common cause for an aging dog that maybe was always very tolerant of things in the past. They start to experience more pain or discomfort due to, you know, joint disease. They may become a little more irritable, a little less tolerant. You know, maybe they didn't mind the kids, you know, sitting on their back when they were younger, but now that causes them pain, and so they may snap and or growl. And again, worst case scenario, go straight to the bite. This is why I tell people, you know, if a dog growls or snaps, that's what it was intending to do. It was warning, you know, if it wanted to bite, it would, but it was warning you. And so we shouldn't ignore those behaviors. They are telling us something that needs to be investigated.
And Dr. Tynes, what can we do? I mean, obviously, if the one example is, hey, when this was a younger dog, didn't mind the little kids climbing on their back, whatever, but now it does. So we just, you know, of course, keep the kids from doing that or keep them away from the dog or at least enough distance before they're trying to saddle up or whatever. But what do we do otherwise when we just see less pronounced, maybe evidence of aggression that is otherwise not familiar to us in that dog?
Any behavior change that occurs suddenly in a dog that is an adult, all right, past what I call social maturity, which is 2 to 3 years of age, any sudden behavior change at that time should be first investigated by your veterinarian, because there are a variety of different medical conditions that could lead to that, even aggression. And so that needs to be well investigated. And if the veterinarian doesn't find anything, what they may do is refer you to a veterinary behaviorist. And that's what I would recommend people do, because dogs have a reason for everything they do. And if we understand what that reason is, we can often change their need to do that behavior, if you will.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of people, when they're faced with a dog who suddenly exhibits aggression, well, they want to punish it, right? They want to make that behavior stop. But if people would look at that behavior as just a sign of some underlying emotional state and something that needs to be investigated, they will have a lot better success. In fact, punishing a dog for aggression can be very, very dangerous. It will likely make the problem worse. It can lead to people being bitten. So my recommendation, if their usual veterinarian can't help them, is to see a veterinary behaviorist or other qualified behaviorist.
And that, I guess, would bring them to someone that's like you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there are only about 90 of us at this time in the United States, but you're very fortunate if many of your listeners are in Florida. You're fortunate to have several veterinary behaviorists in the state of Florida. There's one in Georgia. They're spread somewhat thinly across the country.
Yeah.
And many of them, such as I myself will do, I will consult with veterinarians that maybe live in an area where their clients don't have access to a veterinary behaviorist. So many veterinary behaviorists are willing to consult with other veterinarians to help them work for a case. And some do consulting with clients, even by, you know, telehealth is becoming extremely common now.
Sure.
Especially after the pandemic. And
right.
Veterinary behaviorists are finding ways to offer more telehealth options so that people can get the help they need.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. So sometimes it's directly with the human, with the dog that has perhaps some aggression issues, and sometimes it's with that human's veterinarian in consultation directly with you to sort of help come up with a diagnosis.
Exactly.
Or a solution. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And speaking of some of the ways we've all innovated and had our lives changed in various ways by the pandemic, if we could, let's talk a little bit about the other lecture that you'll be giving at VMX. Actually, before we do that, I'm just curious just about VMX itself. I'm just wondering, have you been to VMX before, either as a speaker or attendee?
Yes, I have. In fact, VMX is probably, it has been my favorite veterinary conference for almost the entire 30 years I've been in practice. It is definitely one of the largest in the country, if not the largest.
Yeah.
And I think everyone is super excited about being able to get back to a big conference and, you know, mingle with our colleagues. We have certainly done a lot of, you know, online conferencing over the last years, online education. But I think most veterinarians will agree with me that the benefits of actually going to a conference in person goes way past just what you learn in the meeting rooms to, you know, what you learn from being able to interact with your colleagues and in this more casual environment, being able to get into that big exhibit hall and learn about what's new. And it's just a really, really great opportunity for veterinarians. And like I said, one of my favorite meetings. I'm super excited to not only be able to attend, but also to present.
And it sounds like it's, as you kind of noted in a way, but just physically, it just sounds like it's kind of humongous.
It is. It is an enormous meeting.
Yeah.
And it, you know, maybe is a little bit smaller this year, but I don't think it will be any less than usual. It just looks like it has a great lineup of speakers, and the exhibit hall will still be there, even with virtual booths, as I understand it. So those people that may attend online still have, you know, access to some of what's in the exhibit hall.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a really a conference worth going to.
That's great. And if I have this correct, I think just regular folks, at least on the virtual side, can participate, just people who have animals or have an interest in animals. Is that correct, or do you actually have to be?
That's actually a great question, but I understand it. I think anybody can register, but I would recommend they go online to the NAVC website and find out more about that.
Right. And again, that's NAVC, just those letters, NAVC.com/VMX, I think, to find out all about the conference. And
because it is a meeting where, you know, practice managers go, technicians go, you know, a lot of different veterinary staff will attend it. So it's not just veterinarians. Students will often take advantage of going to the conference. So
yeah, no, it sounds really sprawling and great in all kinds of ways. So let's talk in our remaining moments here, Dr. Tynes, about the other lecture that you are giving at VMX. I guess sort of anticipating the separation anxiety that may be provoked in dogs as they're humans do start resuming kind of a post-pandemic work schedule and returning to the office or just otherwise going places that takes them away from the house when that hasn't been the case for most of the last year plus. What do we do then? I would guess, like we've talked about in the other part of the conversation, taking preemptive measures is probably important. But what are some tips and guidelines you suggest to help get your dog or dogs better sort of equipped to deal with what may become our increasing absences from the home soon?
Right. Yes, you're absolutely right. If people would plan ahead a little bit, I think we will have a lot less problems. There's certainly no guarantee that any dog is going to develop separation anxiety. But what I like people to understand or think about is that their pets are they're creatures of habit. And any sudden change in their schedule can be distressing and can potentially lead to, you know, stress-associated behaviors that we don't like, or even in some cases, disease processes associated with stress. So there are three things I would like to urge people to consider if they can do it. And the first one is, of course, to try to plan ahead and start slowly. So if you have a new dog, especially, or puppy, that you have been with 24/7 for the last year or even 6 months, then don't just suddenly go and leave them at home for 8 hours. Start out with short periods of time, 5 or 10 minutes, and then slowly over time increase the amount of time that the dog is alone so that they get used to the idea that now they're going to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is I always urge people to make being alone positive. And the way I've always done this is by giving my dog some kind of special treat that she only gets when she's alone. So that every time we get ready to walk out the door, my dog, for example, gets a Kong, you know, stuffed with some kibble and a little peanut butter or cheese or something like that. So a special treat, food dispensing toy like a stuffed Kong is a great way to teach the dog that, oh, being alone is fine. I get this great thing.
Yeah.
And the third, of course, is just, again, it's really about being more proactive than reactive. If you have been giving your dog a lot of attention and walks and that sort of thing steadily for the last 9 months, and you're getting ready to go back to work, think about what your schedule is going to be like when you go back to work and try to slowly begin mimicking or to fully begin giving the dog the schedule that you think you will be able to support when you go back to work. So if you've been walking for an hour every day, then maybe start walking 15 minutes a day if you know when you go back to work you're not going to be able to have those long walks. And just take baby steps in getting the dog used to this new routine.
Yeah. And so, Dr. Tynes, for at least one, if not two of those three things, I'm wondering, like when you say try to plan ahead and also the sort of adjustment in the walk time and some other time that when you know your time at home and walk times and other things are definitely going to be changed and reduced. How far ahead, I mean, if you have the kind of flexibility and you know for sure and can make this kind of plan, how far ahead would you start making those changes?
Well, I would start as soon as I knew that my schedule was going to change.
Yeah.
Because the more time you have, the more slowly you can go.
Yeah.
If you find out you have to go back to work next week,
yeah,
well, you're going to have to kind of proceed through these changes more rapidly and hope that the dog deals with them okay.
Yeah.
So the longer you have to prepare, the better. That way, if you see that your pet actually is developing a problem, you also have time to consult a veterinarian or a behaviorist and begin, you know, trying to do something to help them with that problem before you suddenly go off to work and get much busier than you may have been.
Yeah. No, if it's as soon as a week or so from now, then probably the only thing that's going to fly with that dog is the Kong with the kibble and the peanut butter. Otherwise, it's like, hey, the rest of this, I'm not really going along with this. This is kind of a little too drastic and too fast. But
it's possible. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Dr. Tynes, well, this has been really great and really helpful, and I've certainly learned a lot, and I'm guessing our listeners have as well. So I really appreciate you making the time to join us, and think folks attending the VMX to hear your full lectures on each of these things are fortunate folks indeed. So we've been speaking with Dr. Valerie Tynes. Again, she will be part of the VMX conference later this, starting the 5th, I think, of June. And I think your lectures are both on the 6th, if I want to say.
That's correct.
Yeah. So, again, there's a website to find out more about the VMX and the schedule of speakers and other elements at navc.com/VMX. So, Dr. Tynes, thank you again for joining us today on Talking Animals. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. In a moment, we'll talk with Patrick Rose, Executive Director of the Save the Manatee Club, addressing the dramatic number of manatee deaths at just the halfway mark of this year and what's claiming the manatees in such troubling fashion, on top of the challenges these beautiful animals have already long faced. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with Erin Foley, a longtime Talking Animals fave, though I had forgotten until a few nights ago that she has a role in the film Almost Famous as a Rolling Stone fact checker. But this is Erin and her stand-up guys with a piece called Dogs in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
We're thinking about getting a dog. Dog people clap, yeah? People love the dogs. I love the dog. I've never had a dog. It would be super exciting to get a dog. Not, and funny. hilarious. I don't know what kind of dog I want to get. It just seems like when I look around, there's a lot of aggressive crossbreeding going on with dogs these days. It's weird. I don't even know what I'm looking at anymore. Like, you used to be able to look at a dog and be like, that's a lab. That's a golden retriever. Now you look at a dog and you're like, what the hell is that? It's like a face of like a Doberman, like a shepherd body, but it's so tiny. It's such a tiny dog. And I'm always like, excuse me, what kind of dog do you have? And they're like, it's a German Doberoodle. Yes, yes, yes. I don't know why I didn't go with German Doberoodle. Yes. I was going to go with creepy, because it's a creepy dog. You're creepy, and the whole situation's creepy. I kind of want to, like, push the envelope with the dog owners. You know what I mean? What I want to do is I want to rent a Shetland pony and take it into the dog park. Just to see the look of the dog owner's faces and be like, excuse me, what kind of dog is that? It's like a mutt. I don't know. It's like part Mastiff, Great Dane, Hyena, Collie mix. Something like that. Wow, it just really looks like a Shetland pony. I know, we get that all the time. It's uncanny. Absolutely uncanny, but it's such a great dog. I mean, I haven't even heard it bark. It's just quiet, quiet dog. And then I'm gonna jump on top of it and ride it out of the park.
That was Erin Foley in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Dogs, taken from her album Lower the Bar. Now it's time to speak with Patrick Rose, executive director of the Save the Manatee Club, about a grim picture that's emerged in recent days in CNN and other media outlets about the unusually high number of manatee deaths this year already. This is Patrick Rose on Talking Animals on WMF. Good morning, Patrick.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals again.
Yeah, great to be here.
Thanks. So we did speak on the show almost exactly 2 years ago, but before we get into the focus of today's conversation, maybe you could just give us a quick overview of Save the Manatee Club, its history and mission, just in a kind of a nutshell.
Yeah, well, Save the Manatee Club's really proud to say this is our 40th anniversary year. We were formed in 1981 by Governor Graham, Florida Governor Graham, who went on to be our senator, and Jimmy Buffett. Hopefully everybody knows who Jimmy is, and yeah. They really got together at one of Jimmy's concerts and talked about how more needed to be done to help save manatees, and that became the genesis for Save the Manatee Club. And we've been working hard since then, and we had a lot of positive success, a lot of improvement in terms of the population growing and protections. But sadly, more recently, within the last decade, we've been seeing some pretty serious decline, especially in water quality and seagrasses and habitat protection for manatees, and find ourselves in the middle of a really tragic circumstances where so much pollution over the years has created multiple algal blooms that have shaded out seagrasses and caused us to lose more than 760 manatees this year alone already. So it's pretty serious consequences.
So, Patrick, is that really the focus of algal blooms in terms of what CNN and those other media outlets have reported in those 760 deaths you just mentioned? Is that the chief cause of what's...
There's an unusual mortality event on the east coast of Florida within primarily the Indian River Lagoon, but even stretches beyond that. That's about 150-some-mile-long lagoon. And on the east coast alone, there have been more than 600 manatees die out of that 760. So it's really predominantly focused within Brevard County, portions of Volusia and Indian River County, but Brevard particularly. It's really directly linked to years and years of too much nutrient from human waste, in essence, from the drain fields, from septic tanks leaching into the waterways, to sewage that's not properly treated, to runoff, including fertilizers and other pollutants into the system. And a system, aquatic ecosystem, can only take so much before it begins to collapse and pass a tipping point. And so as those excess nutrients were there, the algal organisms, really, they have these intensive blooms that can be so thick and heavy and toxic that they shade out the light to the seagrasses, which require, you know, that sort of photosynthesis to survive. And then you combine that together with some of the cold that we had this winter, and it just was much too much for so many manatees that ended up nearly literally dying of starvation. We've never had anything like this before. Unfortunately, it's so severe and going to be long-lasting. We could, though, be back here again by next winter. So a lot is being worked on, a lot is being, you know, done, but it's still going to take a very long time to really fix all that's broken.
Yeah, so Patrick, when you say a lot is being worked on, a lot is being done, I mean, with the key picture you described there about the human waste and septic and fertilizer and stuff, seems like it'd be, after you reach that tipping point that you mentioned, seems like it'd be very hard to reverse course in any significant way. Is that what's being attempted, though?
Well, yes, it's being attempted. So some of it will come through steady improvements in water quality by reducing the amount of pollutants going into the system, by removing some of those past nutrients we call legacy nutrients in the form of muck and so forth. But that's still going to be a slow process. And so there may be some seagrass replanting, but it's only going to be effective if the water quality itself has been improved to a point that the algal blooms won't continue. And then effort is being given to those freshwater creeks and small river systems that connect to the Indian River Lagoon, which is an estuarine system, and help replant even freshwater vegetation. We're going so far as to caution even the Corps of Engineers in the state of Florida not to do the normal amount of aquatic plant control back in the freshwater systems, where we have vegetation that may not be native to Florida, but that manatees can find it and consume it In the meantime, it saves chemicals being put in the water, and also saves money. In the meantime, it can also provide manatees a source of food, while we hope over the longer term that the seagrasses are going to be recovered and reestablished.
So, Patrick, having done this quite some time and knowing obviously a lot about how all this works with the water and the plants and the food source for the manatees being greatly reduced, what's your level of optimism in terms of how this is going to play out in the next couple, 3 years?
Well, we're certainly urging the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Florida, together with USGS, to really monitor closely. We're helping supporting other surveys and health assessments to understand how the manatees are doing throughout the summer leading into the winter and being prepared. It may actually be necessary to rescue large numbers of manatees and provide for them while there's a transition time and more of the recovery can happen. So very concerned that it could get even worse this coming winter.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think it highlights these failures that we have had where our human waste is not being taken care of or treated properly or prevented from entering these natural ecosystems. And we're trying to press also at this time for this to be included in infrastructure funding. And it may not be quick, but it just won't happen to the degree it's needed unless they make up for the failures of the past. So we're hoping that how you handle your human waste ought to be a basic infrastructure need. And so we're pressing hard with the Biden administration and other members of Congress to include more funding for this recovery effort within this aquatic ecosystem.
So just about nearing the end of our time, Patrick, but with that in mind, are there steps that we as manatee lovers can take, calls to our legislators, emails, letters, things that we can do that might help in that overall effort?
Absolutely. And so the more that people reach out, make sure that this is understood, that this is a failure of not being sustainable about our growth and development and allowing too much to happen without, taking care of and cleaning that water up before it enters into that system. Save the Manatee Club also has a lot of additional information on our website, savethemanatee.org, where people can learn about it. We have opportunities to join with letter writing campaigns and calls. And most importantly, I would end by saying the most immediate need is to keep an eye out for boaters or those who live along the waterways that see a sick or injured manatees. A manatee should report that so they can be rescued and taken care of. The Manatee Rescue and Rehabilitation Partnership, which is we are a founding member of and a sponsor of it, are working hard to rescue every sick and injured manatee and get them nursed back to health and then put them back out with transmitters and follow them and really understand how well they're doing so for their safe return.
All right. Well, that sounds good. And one more time, that website for all that kind of information and help and guidance is savethemanatee.org. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us once again on Talking Animals. And let's hope things turn around and get better and better for our manatee friends.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I'm Duncan Strauss for listening to Talking Animals. Coming up on WMNF, we continue our public affairs programming. And then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with 360 Degrees of Blues, hosted by Harrison Nash, followed by Scott Ellis. And also's edition of It's the Music. Right now, it's time for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a Lily Brush fantastic gizmo for the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on WMNF. Okay, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition of the show. Those guessing on our name, the animal team, will take off the air. Thanks so much. Stay tuned.